Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Mohammed Ayoub, who is a University Distinguished Professor of International Relations at Michigan State University, where he holds a joint appointment in the James Madison College and the Department of Political Science. He's a specialist on conflict and security in the Third World, and is the author of The Many Faces of Political Islam, Religion and Politics in the Muslim World. He has an article at CNN, Can the World Live with a Near-Nuclear Iran? Welcome to Background Briefing, Mohammed Ayoub.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure.
And yesterday I spoke with Steve Walt at Harvard, and he mentioned he had a kind of wish list for the great diplomatic breakthroughs that could be made but probably won't be made in the context of like Nixon's visit to China. And one of them was the idea that the United States would wake up one day and be suddenly enlightened and decide to take the military option off the table vis-a-vis Iran. And I'm exploring that notion further with you, because I think from your article at CNN, I got the impression that in many ways that you were on the same page as Stephen Walt, in the sense that continuing to threaten this country with a paranoid government that's looking over its shoulder at its own vastly discontented people, by threatening them constantly, you basically force everybody to rally around the flag, and you can't peel off the people that you want to break away from the government, the people that prosecuted the Green Revolution. Is that what you're suggesting?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, it's true in large measure. I think the military option, if exercised, would really be counterproductive, because as I've argued in the article, it may set the Iranian program back by a few years, but it would only energize them to do it much more quickly and much more efficiently. And now, once the attacks have taken place, and even in the glare of publicity, because they wouldn't care about being secretive about it, and they would have a lot of international sympathy as well, and they'd walk out of the NPT. But I don't think that an Israeli or an American or a combined attack would really be able to terminate the program. I mean, they've done things like underground bunkers and all sorts of things. I mean, I'm not a technical person, but from what I've been reading, that lead me to believe that wouldn't be possible. I also think that, as I've argued in this article, that the decision to make nuclear weapons or develop nuclear weapons capability is in large measure the function of the strategic environment of a particular country. And as I've said in this article, the Iranian political elite, and across the board, I think, it's not merely the current ruling elite, but also those waiting in the wings or the opposition, they are of more or less of one mind on this, that they live in a very threatening strategic environment. And the reason is simple. They look to the West and they see a nuclear-armed Israel, which is hostile to Iran. They look to the north and they see Russia, which is nuclear-armed, but also they realize that relations with Russia, while they may be okay currently, historically have been very tense. They look to the east and they see a nuclear-armed Pakistan. And they perceive Pakistan to be, despite the fact that many Pakistanis would like to disagree with it, but they perceive Pakistan as a pawn of the United States. And then, of course, above all, they look south and they see this huge, this massive military buildup, both onshore and offshore, in the Persian Gulf that the United States has and with whom relations have been hostile for the last 30 years or so. And so they feel very much encircled and consequently paranoid. And one of the ways they find that they can get out of this conundrum is to have at least rudimentary nuclear weapons capability. Because, as again I've argued in this article, over the last few years, they've noticed the differential treatment meted out by the United States and its allies to a nuclear-armed North Korea and Iraq, which did not have and nuclear weapons. So they feel that even a rudimentary nuclear capacity could act as a deterrent, because it would create enough uncertainty in the minds of policymakers in Washington and in other European and in European capitals, so that they would desist from attacking Iran, either to overthrow the regime or to bring their nuclear weapons program to an end.
Again, I'm speaking with Mohammed Ayoub, who is the University Distinguished Professor of International Relations at Michigan State University, where he holds a joint appointment in the James Madison College and the Department of Political Science. And he has an article at CNN, Can the World Live with a Near-Nuclear Iran? There's probably another explanation then for the obsession, if you will, on the part of the West. Israel has often threatened to strike or ruminated about striking the nuclear facilities. The Saudis in the WikiLeaks documents have called for somebody to cut off the head of the snake. It's odd to have the Saudis and the Israelis on the same page. But one of the arguments that is made is that a nuclear-armed Iran will therefore lead to a nuclear-armed Turkey and Saudi Arabia. If Saudi Arabia doesn't develop its own, it would perhaps buy a nuclear weapon from Pakistan. Does that concern you?
Not really. No, I think that argument is flawed. I mean, if the Arab states the Arab states of the Middle East had really wanted to build up to build nuclear arsenal or arsenals, the fact that Israel possesses nuclear weapons, and this goes back to the late 60s and the early 70s, would have energized them to move in that direction, but they have not, for a number of reasons: their technological capacity, their relationship with the United States, and also I don't think, there's a whole lot of other factors at work, which I don't think would necessarily, if Iran goes nuclear, would necessarily motivate them to go nuclear. I know that they make this argument, but you have to have a certain industrial and technological infrastructure in order to be able to engage in a serious nuclear weapons program, which I don't think any of these do. I mean, Saudi Arabia has a lot of money, obviously, but it doesn't have that sort of industrial capacity. And I think they make this argument merely to convey to the United States that the Americans should do something about Iran for other reasons.
Well, you have mentioned in your article, Mohammed Ayoub, at CNN, that Ehud Barak, the former prime minister of Israel, now defense minister, responded very candidly in an interview with Charlie Rose that, in fact, if he was in Iran's shoes, he can understand why the Iranians would want a nuclear weapon.
Yeah, that's a remarkable statement. And as I said, it was in a very candid moment, one probably that he regretted after giving the interview, because there was a lot of criticism heaped on him from in Israel and in the United States for having said what he did. But I think he was right. I mean, if you put yourself in the shoes of the Iranian political elite or the Iranian regime, and this is regardless of the nature of the regime, you would come to that conclusion. So, I mean, that's what has led me to conclude that they have undertaken a serious nuclear weapons program. Because if you put yourself in their shoes, it makes it logical or rational for them to do so.
So, given the current environment, where you feel like this is a Cold War that doesn't have the kind of controls and mutually assured destruction discipline, if you will, that the U.S. and Soviet Cold War had. Of course, only one side has the nuclear weapons in this situation, and Iran is hardly in any way comparable to the Soviet Union. However, there's a feeling that we could drift into a clash, as much as everybody recognizes that it would be a complete catastrophe to have a war with Iran. They've tried to restrain the Israelis on the basis of that it would drive up the price of oil and tank the global economy. But nevertheless, it seems that as the pressure builds, you've got the Defense Authorization Act. Apparently, they've watered down some of the provisions to put the screws to Iran's central bank, giving the president some kind of waiver if it affects the price of oil. You've got the U.S. pulling out of Iraq, the possibility of Iranian-backed militias going after a consulate or the Green Zone. You know, we've seen the irrational behavior vis-a-vis the British Embassy. So do you feel that we're on a kind of dangerous glide path here?
Well, I hope we are not, and we don't go down that road, and that the Cold War is, as you mentioned, I hope it doesn't turn hot. But you are very right that this is an asymmetrical situation. It's not like the United States-Soviet Union standoff, where both had the capacity to hit each other's homeland with nuclear weapons and, you know, with nuclear warheads in their hundreds and thousands. Really, this is not that sort of a situation. The Iranian attempt to build a nuclear weapons capability, I believe, is primarily motivated by the notion of deterrence, so that they are able to deter an attack on the Iranian homeland, whether it is to overthrow the regime or for whatever other reason, by building up a capacity that would introduce enough uncertainty so that the attack doesn't take place. As far as Afghanistan and Iraq, you mentioned, that's very germane to this entire equation. Just as you said, and we all know that the American forces from Iraq are going to move out by the end of this year, and there's going to be a winding down of American and allied presence in Afghanistan over the next couple of years. Now, Iran has major interests. It lies between Iraq and Afghanistan geographically. It has major interests. It also has a great deal of influence with certain important actors in both these countries. And I think it would have been politic on the part of Washington to see that its relationship with Iran does not deteriorate to such a point that after its withdrawal or in the process of American withdrawal, that Iran is able to inflict damage on American interests in the region. So I think there should be a recalculation of American interests vis-a-vis Iranian objectives. And the Iranians, to be, in 2002 or 2001, 2002, if you go back that far, they were willing to play ball on Afghanistan when the United States overthrew the Taliban, because actually the United States did them a favor by getting rid of one of their major irritants as far as Tehran was concerned in the region. And then in 2003, they overthrew Saddam, who was the major antagonist of Iran. And in 2001, 2002, the Iranians were willing to play ball, as I said, and were quite cooperative in their at the Bonn conference, at which Hamid Karzai was anointed as president of Afghanistan. This is what the United States wanted, but he was anointed with, in a way, the blessings or consent of Iran. It was unfortunate that soon after that, President George W. Bush made that the State of the Union speech in which he categorized Iran as a member of the axis of evil with Iraq and North Korea, and that really turned around the relationship, the evolving relationship between Iran and the United States. I think the United States should have taken advantage of that cooperation that the Iranian regime had extended over Afghanistan to emphasize the convergence of interests, and indeed the United States and Iran do have a lot of convergence, a number of areas in which their interests converge, in Iraq or in Afghanistan, rather than those areas where their interests diverged radically.
Well, I think it was worse than that, Mohammed Ayoub. Didn't the United States essentially cut off the Iranian liberals or moderates at the knees by not engaging them, and that led to the end of Khatami and that possibility with him as the prime minister? And I recall that shortly after the U.S. invasion of Iraq, the Iranians were quite concerned that they'd be next, after all the neocons had said that. And they sent a delegation through the Swiss to the White House, or at least they reached out to the White House, and Dick Cheney cut them off and basically said, "We don't talk to evil."
No, that's true. The American policy, the axis of evil speech, and the policy in the immediate wake of that speech did contribute to the discrediting of the Khatami government. I don't think it was the only reason why the liberals or the progressives or the reformers in Iran lost the next election. There were a lot of domestic reasons involved as well, but it is true that the United States contributed to it, or American policy contributed to it. But my take now is that regardless of the nature of the regime, I mean, regimes come and go, but state interests remain more or less permanent. And Iran has the aspiration to be the preeminent actor in the Persian Gulf, the preeminent state in the Persian Gulf, and has the aspiration to be recognized as such, as if not, a predominant, at least some sort of a managerial power in that region. I mean, Iran and India and have had similar aspirations. I think finally the Indo-American relationship were put on an even keel when the United States signaled to New Delhi that it was willing to accept India's role as the preeminent power in the region. And I think that sort of approach towards Iran would probably bring a positive, you know, positive responses from Tehran as well.
Well, it seems that the United States has finally listened to the Indian government, at least on Burma, Myanmar, and there's been a recent engagement, and India's been suggesting for some time that they should engage. India has very close relations with Iran. The U.S. and the Saudis have been leaning on India to cut off its buying oil from Iran.
Natural gas.
And yeah, and I believe the Indians have refused. Is that right?
Right. Because the Indians are dependent on the import of energy from Iran, and you know they wouldn't want to totally lose that relationship because it's very important for economic reasons.
Yeah, but the Saudis offered to replace the suppliers. That's my understanding.
Yeah, but the natural gas is I don't think the Saudis would be able to replace the natural gas supply.
I see.
They may be able to replace the oil supplies, but obviously, I mean, Indian-Iranian relations go back a long way too.
Right.
And I don't think the Indians would necessarily dump the Iranians in favor of Saudi Arabia just because the Saudis make some promises. Because there are other complications. The Saudis are very much involved in Pakistan, which New Delhi perceives to be the spoiler in the South Asia region. So the Saudis are seen as one of the primary backers of Pakistan. So there's a whole lot of other variables involved. Iran, although its relationship with Pakistan are on the surface quite good, the Iranians realize that in the long term, their relations, their interests and those of Pakistan diverge. And in fact, their interests and those of India converge, as they did vis-a-vis Afghanistan, for example. I mean, India and Iran were the two principal backers of the Northern Alliance. And Iran actually acted as a conduit for the flow of American aid to the Northern Alliance at the critical moment when the Northern Alliance became the spearhead for the attack on Kabul after 9/11, the terrorist attacks on 9/11.
Well, that may resume, right, the Indian-Iranian pact when the U.S. pulls out and Pakistan, through the Pashtuns and the Taliban, tried to take over the whole country of Afghanistan.
Yeah. So India and Iran have converging interests in Afghanistan as well.
Well, thank you so much for joining us here today.
You're most welcome.
Mohammed Ayoub, been a pleasure.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Again, I've been speaking with Mohammed Ayoub, who is a University Distinguished Professor of International Relations at Michigan State University, where he holds a joint appointment in the James Madison College and the Department of Political Science. His latest book is The Many Faces of Political Islam, Religion, and Politics in the Muslim World, and he has an article at CNN, Can the World Live with a Near-Nuclear Iran? This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbons. This program is available for podcasts, and you can sign up there at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Love.